Hi, everybody. My name is Shauna, and this is the American English Podcast. My goal here is to teach you the English spoken in the United States through common expressions, pronunciation tips, and interesting cultural snippets or stories. I hope to keep this fun, useful, and interesting. Let's do it. Welcome back to this week's episode. Today, we have a special guest named Ben Whateley. Maybe you know him. He's the co-founder and chief strategy officer at Memrise, one of the most celebrated language apps there is. Ben received his master's in experimental psychology from Oxford University and has since been working with language acquisition. In fact, he's a pioneer in the field. Ben helped create the first AI language partner using GPT-3 technology. It's called the Membot. Yeah, I'll repeat that. Ben helped create an AI language partner. Is this the future? It may be. If you're interested in trying it out, I'll provide a link in the episode notes. In any case, today I had the pleasure of tapping into his knowledge with the goal of finding out how we can learn better. In our chat, Ben and I talk about common misconceptions in language learning, the genius of mnemonic devices, and how to acquire new vocabulary effectively. I hope you enjoy it. Without any further ado, let's hear from Ben. Hi, Ben.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to have you. I'm so excited you're here. And I'm not just saying that because I've known about you for much longer than you probably know. I have been using Memrise for, well, I used it mostly back in 2014, 2015, 2016, back when it was focused on images and stuff. And my friends and I were so enthusiastic about it that it was something that we talked about daily. And in that process, I got to know you. I got to hear about Ed Cook, your co-founder, and I'm just thrilled to have you here. So how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Very well.
Very well.
It's school holidays. My children are all around me, but it's a bit busy here.
Yeah.
Good day.
Good. All right. So I'd love to get a little bit of information about you and your background. I read a little bit about you, but I don't know the details of, you know, where you grew up, where you went to school. I believe you went to Oxford, but I don't know much about that. So I kind of would love to hear your background story. Do you mind sharing with us?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I guess my background also as it relates to language learning. When I was at high school, I was not very good at languages. Or I guess specifically, I did fine in my exams because I was kind of good at exams. But whenever I went to France or Spain, I couldn't speak the language. Uh-huh. And I knew that I wasn't any good at the language, even if I got an A grade. And then I went to Oxford to study neuroscience. And I got very into the, specifically into the science of how we learn and how human brains learn effectively. And there, while I was looking at how humans learn language, I sort of came across this idea that I had in my head that I was one of these people that was bad at languages. But the reality of it is that humans are good at languages. If you're a human, there's literally nothing you can do about it. You're good at languages. And it doesn't really make sense to say that you're a human that is bad at languages. What can make sense is that you're a human that's bad at learning languages the way that you're being taught languages. But that's more a problem with how you're being taught languages than it is with your ability. And I think that part of this, part of the problem that we have, I'm straying off my background and now just opining about language, but there you are. Part of the problem we have is in this word or this concept of learning. We think that the language is a thing that we need to learn and therefore someone needs to teach it to us. But in fact, if you look at the overall time you spend getting good at a new language, the time you spend being taught the structures, you know, the grammar and whatever about the language, that should be like well less than 1% of your overall time acquiring the language. The overwhelming time is practicing it. It's listening to podcasts. It's watching films. It's listening, trying to understand people. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, it's trying to communicate your thoughts to someone else using language. And those are the times when you're actually acquiring the language or learning the language, but they're not what happens in language courses.
Right.
And if you look at what happens in the classroom, it's maybe a 50-50 split between teaching you stuff and practicing stuff. Well, that's a disaster. You've only done 2% of your full 100%.
Right.
And while I was studying at Oxford, all of this kind of came clear to me as I was looking at the way that humans learn languages effectively. So when I graduated from Oxford, I went to live in northern China, northeastern China, up on the Siberian border in a city called Chichihar. And I went there to see if I could learn Chinese well to do what I wanted to do and be able to live a life in Chinese, even though I thought I was bad at languages. So I went and lived up there for about a year. And what it turned out was that, yeah, I could, like pretty quickly, I could get good enough to do the things that I wanted to do in the language. And I guess that was where I picked up another idea, which was I didn't need to learn Chinese. I needed to learn the Chinese I needed to do the things I needed to do. And actually, I met a guy up there who was a Canadian, but his parents were Canadian. He'd been brought up in Hong Kong, going to local Cantonese speaking school. Then when he was about 16, he moved to high school in Germany and then went to university in Germany. He said, like, what's my native language? I talk to my parents in English. And if I have to play with small kids, I can do it in English. Mm-hmm. I can't do that in German and I can't do that in Cantonese. I'm pretty funny in Cantonese. And if I'm like hanging out with my mates, it's Cantonese. That's where I do it.
Yeah.
But ask me to write an essay in either English or Cantonese, I'm not great, frankly. And German, that's where I can really, like, if I were going to write a novel, I'd do it in German. Like, which one's my native language?
Yeah.
And that struck me as quite an interesting idea. And also the kind of analogy I have of this very language is so specific to what you need it for. And so if we were to put the way we think about learning a language towards cooking, then we'd say, oh, I really want to learn to cook. But I can't, I'm bad at cooking. I just need to learn everything. And then when we teach cooking, we teach like the principles of frying, the principles of baking, and try and get you to understand what all of the different ingredients in baking are doing and try and teach those to you before you ever do anything. Well, of course, we don't do that.
Right.
We learn to cook by learning to cook one dish. And then we go and learn another dish and then another dish. Yep. And at some point we start to generalize and we're like, well, okay, I'm going to fry an onion. Okay. That's a start. I've done that in a bunch of recipes. Mm-hmm. And I think learning a language is very much more like learning to cook in that respect. Mm-hmm. You need to learn to say hello to someone, greet them. Then you need to learn to say something that you like saying to new people that you meet, which is personal to you. It's not, you know, my French textbooks, which are constantly teaching me to say my father's job. It's like, I've never had that conversation with my friends in English.
Right.
Why suddenly do I want to talk about it in French?
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Sorry, I rambled on for a long time.
That is perfectly fine. Right now, we're talking to a lot of people who regularly listen to podcasts. How important is listening to podcasts and watching TV shows when learning a foreign language? Would you consider these activities passive learning?
I think it's easy to characterize listening to a podcast or watching TV as passive.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's truly passive, then you won't get any benefit out of it.
Right.
But I think if you're listening to a podcast and you're really having to strain a bit to understand, and sometimes you're not quite understanding and you're having to rewind, or you're having to make a guess about what did that mean? That moment of making a guess and then listening on and thinking, well, no, I got that wrong. Testing it, that is when you're learning. And so although it feels or it might look from the outside passive, actually what's going on in your head is you're making a lot of guesses, validating those guesses, your brain's correcting. And that's when, at a sort of scientific level, learning is happening in your brain. It's not the learning that we think of that teachers teach you.
Right.
It's the learning of when new connections are happening in your brain. And those are different things.
Yeah. So that is a good thing to have those shows that maybe you don't understand everything, but you're sitting down and you're focusing and you're just trying to grasp what's happening. That's the learning experience.
Absolutely. There's actually a really good, I think, one of the most influential academics on second language acquisition for me personally is a guy called Stephen Krashen.
Okay.
And he wrote a book called The Natural Approach in about 1983. Definitely worth watching some of his videos if you haven't come across him. Actually different concepts that he has. One is that the only way to acquire an ability in a foreign language is by processing target language input at just above your current level. So he calls that I+1 content. If you are taking in content at just above your current level, then you are learning. But he makes quite a bold statement. That is the only way, which at the beginning, that seems unlikely. The reason I think he's right is that if I abstractly learn a new grammar construction and can explain it, when I hear that grammar construction being used, meaning doesn't immediately appear in my mind. I might hear it and I go, oh, they're doing that thing.
Yes.
Therefore, it means that. Okay, got it. Once I've done that, next time I hear it, meaning just appears.
Yeah.
And that only happens because I went through that moment of it being just outside my mind. What the explicit knowledge can do is mean that more target language content is just above my current level rather than way above my current level.
Right.
Because if it's way above, I just shut off.
Exactly. I mean, it's words in context. You know, if you pick up a book and it's a little bit too challenging, you don't understand anything from context. Actually, it's kind of funny. So I spent some time in Spain and I thought, oh, I'm a good language learner. I'm just going to learn Spanish. And I moved there and started teaching at an elementary school. I was supposed to have an intermediate level and I didn't. And so I started learning actively and it was just a big disaster because people always say, oh, you know, if you go to a country, you immerse yourself, you're going to learn a language. And very quickly, I realized if I just had a basic level, I would understand so many parts of these simple conversations and I would be picking up words from context. But if I have nothing and if it's too far above me, I'm not learning anything. I'm just wasting time. So it's so important to have, you know, that intermediate or like basic.
I had a friend when we were living in China years ago, their daughter, native English speaker, at the age of 4, went to a Chinese language nursery school. She had zero Chinese. The teachers there made zero allowances for her. Like they didn't speak slowly to her like you do normally to children or try and do sort of big actions. They kind of felt that she was stupid because she didn't understand what they were saying. And after a year, she still spoke no Chinese, which people just say is not possible.
Great example.
But I saw it happen. She spoke none at all. Whereas for various reasons, in my house at the time, we spoke a lot of Chinese. We had Chinese people living all around us and it was like, they didn't speak English. So we spoke stuff in Chinese. So my daughter was already quite used to hearing a lot of Chinese around and had a bunch of phrases.
Yeah.
And when she went to school, you know, within weeks, she just flicked between the two. That's only possible if you have people paying attention and speaking to you in that way that they moderate their language. And this is like caregivers do this for children naturally.
Yeah.
They speak more simply. Actually, people do that with adults as well who don't speak the language well. It sometimes feels like they're talking to you like you're stupid.
Yes.
Because it's kind of, I think we do the same thing if we're talking to someone that we think is really stupid. We talk slowly. Do you get me now? And we actually do the same thing if we're talking to someone who we think doesn't understand.
Yeah.
But it's not rude. It doesn't need to be rude. It can actually be genuinely helpful and kind of essential to picking up the language.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking on Chinese related things on Memorize a long time ago, I remember seeing a deck where there was a picture of a chicken. It looked like a chicken. And then it morphed into the characters of chicken, the word chicken. So I'm curious if you can talk on mnemonics, because this is a mnemonic device, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is our first product to memorize was I'd been in China learning Chinese. And the way we think about language learning and memorize is three steps are essential. There's learn, immerse, communicate. As I say, of the 100%, the learn part in time should be like low single digit percentages of your time, 1 to 5%. Immerse and communicate are the really, really big things. But we were looking for our first route to market, and learn is what people were doing already, and that we knew that we could apply memory techniques to make that work much, much better, particularly in Chinese, where at the time where we started Memrise, I remember going to talk to the Chinese department at Oxford, where the way that Chinese characters were taught was they had this wonderful old Chinese lady with a cane, and she would make you copy out the characters faster and faster and then hit you if you got them wrong.
Yeah.
And that was the traditional approach. And it took people a really long time to learn them. You do learn to write the characters well if you do stroke order and all of those things. It's true. It takes you a blooming long time. Using mnemonics, you can do it much faster. You can learn a whole bunch. I think in one experiment, I remember teaching, 100 characters that you needed to read a Chinese menu. And people could very easily do it in an hour to an hour and a half.
Was that perhaps the one that was on Memrise previously?
Yeah.
Because I think that I did that course. Yes. And then there was like the chicken was at the beginning of it. And then it kind of went to like a fast food place or something. And then...
I might have some of the original pictures here.
Oh my gosh. I remember this from 8 years ago. The fact that I remember these images from 8 years ago, that says something about the effectiveness of images and word association with pictures. It's nuts.
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful. I think it's incredibly powerful for Chinese characters where a lot of it is ideographic. In the case of chicken, I don't think it's intended to be a picture of a chicken, but you can make it look pretty close.
Yeah.
There are others that genuinely are supposed to be like that. It was funny when in those early days, I remember you could add comments under the mnemonics. And we quite regularly see things like, I remember on the Japanese course, there was one of the first characters had underneath it a comment from someone saying, "This is so stupid. Do you think I'm a baby? I don't want to have like cartoon pictures. You guys are morons." And then a comment from the same person 3 weeks later saying, "On the other hand, I can't forget this character."
Exactly.
Yeah, it was a funny piece of product development because a lot of people hated it when they saw it. Or they would say, "No, that character's etymology isn't supposed to be a picture of the." And you're like, "I don't care.
Doesn't matter. You don't forget that stuff."
Right, but it took a lot to get people over that hump.
An obstacle in the way, but you know, that's, I think when people do see it and see how it works, they'll be more convinced and they can incorporate that more into their own learning habits and things like that. Like I do have one more example that I remember from a long time ago. And this is actually not just about characters. This is about pronunciation. I was doing the Russian one. I don't even know if you guys have this on the internet still, but there was a picture of a piece of bread and there was a picture of a jar of jelly. And it was Russian pronunciation of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. And it had a picture of Brad Pitt's face in the bread and her face in the jelly. And it's like, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. And I thought, I will never, ever forget that. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that entirely correctly, but see, it sticks. Sticks.
That's pretty hilarious. Yeah, I think those things are, they're super powerful. And I think that the, particularly as I say, in Chinese characters and Japanese kanji, they are also powerful, but less so for learning words, or more intermittently so for learning words, the sounds of words. And so doing the, this sounds like this, and putting it together. Those mnemonics can be really, really helpful. They can kind of get in the way and end up with a really strong memory of a picture, and you're like, "I just can't remember what that picture is there for."
Right.
That does also happen. But overwhelmingly, they're a really powerful tool. I guess the reason that we don't have them on Memrise at the moment, where we went away from them, is really this point of where you should be spending your time. And we got to the point where people were able to learn, like, We had a month-long learning contest at one point where someone learned 30,000 words in a month.
I love that you did that. That is so cool.
It was pretty stiff competition as well until it came down the last few days until the guy in second place is like, whoever this guy is a... Yeah, insane.
Was this with learners on the platform or was this with people in the office? Because if Ed Cook was part of this, learners. I feel like he would kick butt.
Yes, Ed would do extremely well, but I don't know that he would stick at it for a month.
Okay.
Like that took a pretty insane level.
But 30,000 words, that's
30,000 words. He was doing 14 hours a day. But the thing is, that doesn't get you to speaking the language. So we made this very conscious shift towards, and this is about 6 or 7 years ago, towards what do we need to do to actually get people speaking, to be confident speaking a new language? And the answer there is like a lot to do with video. And so what we have at the moment on the platform, which is what we've been aiming for a long time, but we finally got this live, is that we can take video content from anywhere on the internet, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, and we can bring that into the platform, create a transcript of it, match that against the best phrases for you to learn. So when you've got a transcript, you don't want to just learn every single word in the transcript, because if it says, by the way, you don't want to learn by, with, and way, because that doesn't actually help you to know what by the way means. So match it against the right items in the dictionary so that you can do two things. One, if you are interested in Italian cooking, we can say, here's this video on Italian cooking. Learn these phrases, and then you'll understand the video. And we have done that with trailers for films, with scenes from films. It's like, you want to understand this bit of the film? Here's the words and phrases. So now you can watch it and understand. Given that we know the words and phrases that you've learned, we can then say, well, here are a bunch of videos that you can now watch. So to combat this problem of content being too far over your head, we can now tune it to be just above your head, because we know what words and phrases you know. So we know that this video is just at your level. So that's a massive kind of unlock in that piece of technology. And then the other piece of technology that we've just landed, thanks to the developments in generative AI, is the Membot, which is this AI language partner that can hold totally human-like conversations with you about any subject. And so we set up situations that you have to try and do something in the language, and you can have that conversation. You can have that conversation, but it's kind of better than real life because you don't need to feel embarrassed. If you do get stuck, you can press a translate button and be like, oh, I thought they were saying something totally different, but no, I've done the translate. But you can also ask for hints if you're stuck and you don't know what to say. And so you can ask it for a hint and it'll suggest. And then you can add those to the list of words that you want to learn. So again, it's sort of tying it all back to the engine of memorizing words. But where you're actually spending most of your time is watching videos or practicing communicating in the language. And that's where we really wanted to kind of shift our focus to and make sure that people don't overspend time in the learning the words and phrases, because we got to this point where people thought that learning the words and phrases was the aim. And that's just not the aim. You want to forget the translation and get to the point where you're just processing it. The translation is only a stepping stone to get to actually having the language in your head.
And why did you choose video as being sort of the medium for introducing this information?
What alternatives would there be?
I love it. Yeah, I know so many people spend so much time on YouTube these days. It kind of is a natural, sounds like it would be a natural thing to gravitate towards.
Well, actually, I go further than that. So what we are trying to give people is the opportunity to have a lot of content that they can try and understand that is just above their current level. So for quite advanced learners, late, intermediate, and advanced, you can get by with just audio. It's quite hard, though, because you don't have the visual cues of people's facial expressions, people's gestures. And those actually do make it, particularly at the beginner levels, way, way easier to understand. So there's Stephen Krashen video where he's giving a talk and he says, Mein Kopf. And he's talking about German and he's pointing at his head. And I've never learned that translation,
right.
But it's like, oh, okay, you're pointing at that. I get it. And those kinds of gestures. So that's why, particularly for beginners, video is so important, because if you just have audio and there are words in it you don't understand, you're just lost. Whereas if there's video as well, it's much easier. I actually once did this as an experiment. I got a bunch of people, I taught them a whole load of words, and then I taught them to say different sentences and phrases that use those words. Then I changed one word in the sentence and I played the audio to them. And I asked them to estimate how many words I'd changed or how many new words there were. And the average was 4. In fact, it was one syllable changed. But the fear effect of just hearing this, and this was a language they had no exposure to before. So they'd learned just one thing and they were just like, whoa, it's different. It's totally different. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But then when they watched a video, when they watched a video with someone changing just one, they correctly saw that it was just one thing changing.
How odd.
And it's partly the similarity of the video gives them more similarity to, this is not done to a level of scientific experiment. Mm-hmm. This is not published and peer reviewed. This is me trying to run lots of little tests in our office to try and better understand how to make products. So I don't want to confuse this with being a scientific finding, but my read of this is that when they're looking at a video, most stuff is the same and the behavior of the person is the same. And where the word changes, they can kind of see from the actions what the change is. And actually, in that case, the word that I changed was cat to dog.
Okay.
And so the video, they were pointing at a dog and it was like, well, it's one word different. It's a dog, not a cat.
Yeah. So at a beginner phase, then, yeah, probably leave someone feeling much more comfortable or at ease with themselves and in the moment and not being freaked out by hearing that change, right?
Exactly. Panic is the... So this is another interesting thing about memory and memory's relationship to language learning. So anxiety and a little bit of fear can be really good for forming memories. And it's intense, you're focused, you're under pressure. But for recall, it's not good. And for flowing practice, it's not good. In fact, it's terrible. We remember things much worse when we're anxious. And the more stressed you get, the worse you do. So when you're trying to practice a language, you need to be as relaxed as possible so that you can recall things without stress and be okay with just talking them out until you strengthen that muscle and get used to doing that. And if we put this block of stress on you at the moment that you're first trying to use the language, we don't just make it hard for you now, but we make it harder for you. You weaken your ability to remember those things. So it's a really, really painful thing. And you get more and more used to not being able to speak because you get frozen by that fear. And so that's why you see that sort of trope that a lot of people who drink alcohol think that they get better at speaking their target language after a couple of drinks. It's because their self-monitor drops down. They get less anxious. They get less worried about how they look, which has other ramifications.
Yes, but of course.
Even though alcohol also harms your ability to remember things, the effect of lowering your anxiety is more important than the effect of degrading your memory, at least at low doses. Yes. Like if you drink loads, then that is all out the window.
Yeah. No, but it reminds me of just conversations in general, high stress conversations I've had where suddenly I'm at a loss of words. Like, for example, talking to you. Like we have actually, I've stalked your LinkedIn before this and I noticed we actually have a lot of people in common, like Ellen Jovin and Alex Rawlings and Richard Simcott. You know, like we have all these people that we know that are similar and we actually are in the same field. There's no reason to be nervous with you. I mean, now I feel very comfortable with you. But at the same time, you know, in the beginning, I start stuttering. I can't remember certain words because I don't think naturally I'm an extrovert. And so those sorts of like little anxious feelings come naturally in a conversation. So, I mean, it's the same thing with native speakers.
Totally, totally. And I think the difference between speaking your native language and speaking another language is not as big as it sort of feels to us. You know, the problems are exactly the same. And I think it is a big problem for more introverted people to practice a language. Like when I talk to, when I see the people like Alex Rawlings or Richard Simcott, they just are happy talking to people.
Yeah.
And they love that connection and talking to people. You know, Richard's just incredible at that.
Yeah.
And that is such a superpower.
It's a superpower. When you're learning
a language.
It is.
Whereas if you don't have that, it's really hard to make yourself overcome that. I actually, Rob Patterson, who is our most multilingual team member at Memrise, who speaks about 15 languages, I think. And I was really pleased to hear him say that when he's learning a new language, he often has the experience where he spends months learning it. Then he goes to the country, and the first time he's trying to talk to someone, his overwhelming wish is to just talk in English. Just be like, I can't do this.
That's human nature. I mean,
yeah, but he knows that if he lets himself off the hook the first time, then he's going to do it every time.
Yeah.
And so he has got a way of like talking to himself and be like, come on, Rob, we're going to do this.
Actually, because I've been there too. You know, I've been in France sitting in that coffee shop going, I really want to talk to the person next to me. Look at, they look really interesting. They're maybe reading a book I read too. Like I could start the conversation. You're sitting there. And if you build it up for too long, then you kill it because you have to speak within the first 5 seconds that the idea comes to mind. Otherwise, the chances of you actually saying it are like very minimal. Got to do it.
Yeah. The other trick I have for that, which actually Ed Cook is so good at, is just like, what is the negative that could happen from me saying this? And if you really think about it, I mean, nothing really. So why not?
I think the regrets come from not doing something more often than doing something. So go out on a limb and talk to people. Do you know anything about memory palaces? I know it's kind of a big topic.
I mean, I know a reasonable amount about memory palaces. I'm not an Ed Cook memory grandmaster, but okay. You know, shall I explain what a memory palace is?
Yes, please.
So it's based on the idea that just playing to the strengths of the human mind, we're really good at remembering locations and places. And so remember incredibly nuanced details about places. Like I can remember back to the school I was at when I was 10. And I think my way through the school, I know all my way through it. I even know things like the weight of a door. I know when I push against that door, how's that going to feel? And how does it like flick on its hinges? And then that one is a bit different. You know, there's so much information encoded in our knowledge of space because it's so important to us. And we can use that knowledge of space to associate with things that we need to remember. So one example would be remembering lists of things. So I could create a memory walk around my garden and I could choose 15 different places around my garden and just remember that walk and make it an obvious one so I will never get lost. I know that I walk in the gate, I walk past the pond, I walk over the bridge, you know, I know what those spots are. Then I can remember lists by just making an association at each of those spots.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I want to recall it, I just go on that walk and I just remember what was happening at each day. So that kind of ordered thing is very good for remembering ordered lists. So I guess the most use I've got from memory palaces is memorizing poetry, where putting my children to bed, they used to take a long time to go to sleep.
Yes.
And I tried telling stories and I had two problems. One was that I used to fall asleep telling the story and then I would wake up and find myself telling a story and I'd be like, I just don't even know what I was talking about. But they also, if you made the story too interesting, the children would never go to sleep.
Yes.
It was a disaster. So you have to, and then you just put off the point at which you'd have the difficult conversation with them. So I started learning epic poems and just longer and longer ones. I think the longest, it was How Horatius Held the Bridge from a book called The Lays of Ancient Rome by Lord Macaulay, which takes about an hour to go through.
Did you ever record yourself? Because this is what I do. It's kind of cheating. I actually did a few podcast episodes that are stories like, oh, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And I made them pretty long. And I actually just turn on myself, my podcast, and I'm like, look, I'm speaking. And then I'm like, go to sleep. Did you ever record yourself?
I didn't ever actually do that. I used to have to lie in bed next to them. So I was there.
Yeah.
Oddly, I got to a stage of automation. So the memory palace was essential at the beginning to learning the poem and going all the way through it. But now, if I go through that, I have a vague sense of the direction, but now just the rhythm of the poem takes it. And I got to a level of automation where I could actually compose emails in my mind whilst I was reciting a poem. It was just so completely automated that I could write emails whilst doing it, which was quite an extreme level.
You are AI. You yourself can be the new ChatGPT.
Yeah, I didn't feel great about the level of attention I was paying to my children's bedtime, to be perfectly honest. But I did also think, you know, we're half an hour into, you should be asleep by now. So I'm going to start doing my work.
That's so funny. Oh, that's so funny. I love that. I love learning about memory. And I'm curious, is there anything else that you would like to share with the listeners about yourself, your language learning journey, something that you've learned or anything?
Anything. I mean, I think we've covered a huge amount here.
Mm-hmm.
I guess now I'm going to come up completely blank. I think you've asked me about everything in my life.
Yeah. Well, what are you doing for the rest of the evening? Are you going to go to sleep soon or?
I'll be picking up children, taking children around. I have four children who take up a lot of time, joyfully take up a lot of time. So we can, but it does mean on a Friday evening, there are a lot of activities to take people to and from.
That's
so
great.
I'll certainly be doing that.
Well, enjoy your evening. Thank you so, so much for coming on the show. It was a pleasure hearing from you. Finally, I feel like I've like knocked something off my bucket list.
I'm very flattered and slightly amazed by that. But
yeah.
It's a real joy to be here. And thank you so much for having me.
All right. Yeah, of course. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was fun, wasn't it? After this chat, Ben and I talked quite a bit more about memory techniques. I wish I had that on the recording, but I'm sure we can have him back in the future to talk about how to memorize new words effectively. In any case, what I like about Memrise is how they've integrated real video of native speakers into their lessons and quiz you on conversations. In a way, it feels like you're immersed more so in real-world situations than some of the other apps I've used. The AI language partner, Membot, is also fascinating. I joined as an English learner just to see how appropriate the robot's responses were to the things I was saying, and I was pleasantly surprised. At times, it felt like it was cracking jokes in a way that made me wonder, is there really not another person on the other side of this screen? It's crazy. I think it's worth trying out even just to get a glimpse of what the future of language learning looks like. You'll find the link to try it in the episode notes. And if you do, I'm genuinely curious to hear what you think. So write to me on Instagram at American English Podcast. I hope you enjoyed our talk. Hope you're having a nice day. And until next time, bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the American English Podcast. Remember, it's my goal here to not only help you improve your listening comprehension, but to show you how to speak like someone from the States. If you want to receive the full transcript for this episode, or you just want to support this podcast, make sure to sign up to premium content on AmericanEnglishPodcast.com. Thanks and hope to see you soon.